I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Consensus or Controversy. As today we speak about the management of mantle cell, diffuse large B-cell, and Hodgkin lymphoma. We have an outstanding faculty today, Dr. Stephen Ansell from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Dr. Craig Moskowitz from the University of Miami Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Center down here in South Florida, our way, and Dr. Laurie Sen from the University of British Columbia. We also have some additional faculty people who I worked with prior to this conference and recorded their comments, and you'll see in short one-minute videos, which we jokingly call TikTok, coming off the new app that's based on one-minute videos. But you're going to see a bunch of one-minute videos tonight on some of the most controversial questions, just to add some other opinions to our faculty tonight. If you're into audio programs, and we know lots of people end up listening to these webinars on demand, check out our Oncology Today podcast, including a recent program I did with Laurie on presentations from the recent ASH meeting. But we're here today to talk about the management of these three lymphomas. So much has happened, so much new. I actually met with each one of our faculty separately prior to this in the last couple weeks, and recorded an in-depth presentation reviewing all the data relevant to the questions we're discussing tonight. Tonight, we're here to talk about taking care of patients. We're here to talk about controversies, but all the granularity of the data behind it is in these presentations. Here's where we're heading tonight. These are eight questions that we're going to address specifically. We also did a survey of the audience, and we're going to show you how the registrants to this conference tonight are managing patients in the same situations. We're going to ask the faculty, and we also asked the people to fill out in the survey what questions they wanted to ask you. I got about 40 of them right here, just for starters. We'll see how many of these we can get into the conference. But before we start buzzing down this road, I just want to take a deep breath and talk a little, just the first second, about the issue of bringing new developments in clinical research into practice and all that that involves. And Steve, you know, our main target is the general medical oncologists, the docs in community practice. They're taking care of breast cancer, myeloma, bladder cancer, you name it. And they're keeping lots of new things happening today. And in this, what we're going to talk about today as we go through this agenda, there's so much going on here. If we look at mantle cell, for example, we go back to our agenda, you know, there's the issue of BTK inhibitors, CAR T therapy, sequencing of them, all new. Diffuse large B cell, not only CAR T therapy, we have a bunch of newly approved agents in either the post-CAR T and patients not eligible for CAR T. How do you sort all that out? And then finally, for the last few years, so Steve, we've been trying to integrate the Echelon 1 data into practice. I just was curious about your thoughts about the challenges, particularly for docs in practice, Steve, to bring these new advances in. I was kind of flashing on this paper when the BR came in. I don't know if people are sort of new to oncology or aware of the fact that it wasn't that long ago that BR really came into practice, particularly for upfront treatment of follicular lymphoma, also mantle cell as well. And, you know, although there was a benefit to R-CHOP, Steve, it was a while before people actually picked up on it. And I kind of see the same thing happening. We'll get to that later in the program in terms of first-line therapy of Hodgkin and integration of Echelon. Steve, any thoughts about the issue of when and how to bring new developments into practice?
Well, firstly, I must say I do applaud many people in private practice and general oncologists, because they often are staying up on things and clearly often the people who embrace some of the newer ideas the soonest. And in fact, if we take the BR versus R-CHOP, practicing clinicians often were those that incorporated it first, and some of the academics were a little slower on the uptake. But I think one of the challenges was just the data kind of broke slowly. And there was sort of a number of abstracts that came out, and many of the folks were waiting for the more published complete manuscripts before they said that they felt that this was a practice-changing event. But in practice, actually, because of the favorable toxicity profile, many people were already testing it out in private practice. So I think the slowness actually came with just the delay in actually getting all the information out. But once we had it, I think folks were quite happy to change.
And Laurie, you know, thinking back to, you know, 10 years ago, I'm not sure we're seeing as many press releases as we do now. It seems like every time we start a webinar, people are reminding me which press release we should be talking about. Of course, here we've seen two really exciting press releases in June in diffuse large B-cell. We don't know what the data shows. This happens every day, it seems like, in oncology. We have the phase 3 TRANSFORM study with liso-cel that apparently shows benefit compared to autologous transplant. And also the phase 3 ZUMA-7 trial with axi-cel, same thing, comparing to transplant. Looks like maybe we're about to have a practice change. Again, any thoughts about this sort of process of bringing things into practice, Laurie?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we have to be very careful with these early press releases. And in both those scenarios, these were company releases that were really required, you know, based on the need to inform investors and to release data of an ongoing trial if there is a positive result. So I think most of us are quite enthusiastic, but we've got just a glimpse of the information at this point. So that information will certainly come out. I think most of us anticipate seeing it at the ASH meeting, and we may very well see a huge change in the paradigm of what we do for patients with relapsed refractory DLBCL. But I think, you know, those early press releases aside, I think what we're really struck with is how quickly data is emerging on the novel agents, how quickly the FDA is perhaps moving these novel agents on very early data, limited numbers of patients, sometimes most commonly single-arm studies, into you know, practice so that people can actually benefit from them. And I think that's been a real change in my perspective, that, you know, we're left grappling with relatively small amounts of data because these drugs are coming out and becoming available much earlier, I think, based on quite an impressive shift, I would say, on the part of the FDA to try and get these drugs into patients earlier.
So final comment from Craig about this phenomenon. Curious, particularly because, you know, involvement with Hodgkin and the Echelon study, how you've seen that process. We'll talk more later when we get to that about, you know, sort of how these clinical issues. But just kind of curious, Craig, how you've observed this, you know, slow change as people begin to shift, particularly in a trial like Echelon, comparing, you know, two therapies with available drugs as opposed to newer drugs. Any thoughts, Craig?
So I think when that study was designed, the investigators in the lymphoma community were expecting drama, that there was going to be a very large difference in the investigational arm versus the standard ABVD arm. And despite the fact that the study is clearly positive and really quite good, I mean, better than anything else we have out there, because the results weren't as robust as they could have been, there was slow uptake in the academic community. There were other issues that maybe was not the best control arm, but quite as Steve said before, our practice partners really, you know, really took the hold on this. And, you know, we're giving pretty much everybody with advanced stage Hodgkin lymphoma BVAVD. And we, you know, and clearly there was a less relapse rate. And I think then we just then, you know, followed along, you know. I think it was muted enthusiasm by the lymphoma investigators. Probably wrong in retrospect.
So I'm just sitting here watching this go by and, you know, calling the shots like it's a, you know, football game or something, trying to figure it out as well. So let's start getting into the meat of this, and we're going to approach these 8 questions. The first one, and I'll say this was the most common question our audience has, is not only second line treatment, but specifically the use and choice of BTK inhibitors. Here's what our consulting docs had to say about that.
Acalabrutinib is the agent that I would think about in this setting. I think zanubrutinib may be an emerging option that comes forward for those types of patients. Acalabrutinib I have more personal experience with, and because of the safety profile issues.
We don't have comparisons between acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, at least directly at this point. So I think either one would be a reasonable choice. What I've actually found is that reimbursement is an issue.
Zanu can be given either daily or twice a day, whereas acala is twice a day. Acala, you can't give to people who are on proton pump inhibitors. I've used both in this patient population, and They both have FDA labels because their phase two trials done at different time point with different patients and different investigators. And so to my standpoint, I think they're equal until proven otherwise.
R squared in this population might actually be underutilized. I think it's a very good regimen. And we'll be presenting data at Lugano that shows roughly 3 years of disease control with R squared in mantle cell lymphoma.
So, Steve, any thoughts about second line therapy? Again, BR is often the first line therapy with mantle cell. What about these options and particularly also choice of BTK inhibitor? I might mention we asked the faculty to put together so-called chalk talks, one slide that summarizes all the points they want to make, and we'll get to that one in a second that Laurie did. But Steve, any thoughts?
Well, I think, again, in most practices, you've gone pretty intense with your frontline treatment with chemotherapy, sometimes consolidating with a transplant. So it makes all the sense in the world to now come at it with an entirely different approach. And I would say that in our practice, BTK inhibitors in general are kind of the preferred route. I do think the point about R squared was very legitimate. But I think if you were to press me and say, what would I use, I would most typically use acalabrutinib.
So, Laurie, here is what our audience says about this question. The most common answer they give is acalabrutinib, but closely followed by zanubrutinib. Almost a quarter of the audience, though, says ibrutinib, and 12% says R squared. Our faculty, and we included not just the three of you, but our entire faculty, including for our other program we did on FL and CLL, clearly is on board with a second generation BTK inhibitor, mostly acalabrutinib. But not completely. We asked the audience if they ever used a BTK inhibitor up front. Very few people have, but a lot say they would for the right patient. Same thing with the faculty, although a lot of the faculty actually have already done it, particularly patients are considered maybe not frail or eligible for chemotherapy. Laurie, here's your chalk talk slide about trying to separate out the BTK inhibitors. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I think some of the points have already been made through the video snippets that you saw, that right now, you know, we've got a series of BTK inhibitors, and we don't have direct head-to-head comparison, particularly in mantle cell lymphoma, to say that one is better than the other. So I think you have to be careful. You know, the original trial with ibrutinib was a much more highly pretreated patient population, so you certainly can't compare across the board in efficacy. And I think the consensus is that these drugs are likely to be equally effective. So choice really then revolves around toxicity. And while we don't have head-to-head comparisons in mantle cell lymphoma, there's a lot of data emerging now with head-to-head comparison of ibrutinib versus acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib. And I think the message is that the second generation BTK inhibitors do offer a better toxicity profile. In terms of major toxicities that we worry about, atrial fibrillation, that certainly is lower with the second generation agents. I listed some of the toxicities here on this slide. I probably should have shown you was all grade hypertension, which we know is also lower with second generation agents such as acalabrutinib, even though grade 3 or higher hypertension is not different. So, you know, what is probably not on this slide is some of the nitty-gritty toxicities that people experience on a day-to-day basis that are harder to measure objectively, things like myalgias and fatigue. And for most people that have had experience giving ibrutinib and some of the second generation agents, there's a definite perception on patients that many of these everyday sort of quality of life symptoms are lessened with a second generation. So in the absence of comparative trials, I think they're all equally effective, but my choice now is to go to a second generation agent. I have had the most experience with acalabrutinib, so it is kind of my go-to BTK inhibitor now for mantle cell lymphoma. But, you know, certainly there'll be more data emerging over time to guide practice.
And of course, in our CLL FL program, we got into, you know, similar questions as it relates to CLL. And we know, if we go back to the slides, you know, that these are not identical agents and their coverage is not identical. We saw the big CLL trial comparing ibrutinib to acala at ASCO, and then at EHA, we saw the Zanu trial compared to ibrutinib in CLL. We saw clear differences there in terms of tolerability with both trials. But Craig, in the CLL programs, we're talking a lot about LOXO-305, now called pirtobrutinib. Super exciting situation, but it's also been looked at mantle cell. Do you have any enthusiasm about this? And where do you think this agent is heading, Craig?
So I actually really like this drug. We've had the studies open now for a couple of years. The best way to explain it is the patients never call. I've not seen any toxicity at all with this agent. And I think the efficacy, as Laurie says, I think they all are equally efficacious. But I would say that, living down here in South Florida with an elderly patient population, there's a lot of phone calls with patients on ibrutinib. I mean, it has a lot of side effects, from rash to GI upset to obviously AFib and whatnot. LOXO is going to be a potential game breaker if the phase 3 studies come to fruition. It's really non-toxic.
So let's go through a couple other mantle cell issues and controversies. One, and we asked our auxiliary faculty about, is the current role of venetoclax. Of course, we talked a lot about venetoclax in our CLL program, but we asked them where they see things going in terms of venetoclax and mantle cell, and here's what they said.
I think venetoclax in mantle cell is really something that has some single agent activity, but it really is relatively modest as a single agent. There are a lot of clinical trials in combination with a BTK inhibitor that suggest it may be interesting. I think venetoclax is going to turn out to be most useful in combination rather than a single agent.
Venetoclax is a valuable agent in the relapse setting for mantle cell lymphoma. I've typically used that for patients who have failed frontline therapy and then failed a BTK inhibitor. Michael Wong from our group has explored both the combination of ibrutinib and venetoclax, and now thinking about exploring other BTK inhibitors in combination with venetoclax. That may be a pathway to time-limited therapy.
You may need to do something to bridge that patient. And if it's a short-term bridge, I think that venetoclax is a decent option. It's not labeled. I also think R-squared is a good option in that setting. But if somebody's got a rapid progression, you got to come up with a long-term solution for them.
So Steve, when we asked the audience where they're thinking about venetoclax, most of them say after a BTK inhibitor, although some say after BTK, lenalidomide, or maybe R-squared. We asked the faculty, you said after a BTK inhibitor as well. Other people say later. Any thoughts, Steve, about the efficacy of venetoclax? Any thoughts about John's comment that it really works better in combination?
Yeah, so I actually do think John is correct. I mean, the results are encouraging, but, you know, third line and beyond kind of treatment, the duration of the response is quite modest. And I do think we have other options. I think in this space, CAR T cells are now a really promising approach. And so I think as one utilizes those agents, I think you need to be thinking about what are you going to as the subsequent step. Either that or it's going to need to be in combination. But many times if you already used a BTK inhibitor, the combinations with a BTK inhibitor in my mind don't make a lot of sense. So I would be more in favor of using it after the BTK inhibitor and possibly planning, if possible, if the patient's appropriate, to move toward CAR T cell therapy if eligible.
So Craig, this is a question we got from our audience on our survey. I want you to think about and answer after I give Laurie a chance to go through her Chalk Talk slide. But I want you to think about this, Craig. This is what we call oncology improv. So here's the question, Craig. With the presence of a P53 mutation in an indolent non-nodal mantle cell, change your management approach? So we'll hold on to that for a second. Laurie, here's your Chalk Talk slide about the role of venetoclax. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so, you know, as others have stated already, there definitely is single agent activity with venetoclax, but it is still relatively modest. And most importantly, the durability of benefit is short. So we have some data, you know, from the phase 1 trial, and then more recently, a nice publication that looked at, you know, what could be achieved with venetoclax after patients have failed BTK inhibitor, and that's that slide on the left, where you can see the progression-free survival is relatively short at just 3.2 months, but the overall response rate is 50%, and there are some patients that get quite impressive responses. But I would I would agree it's an available option, but in general, it's going to provide probably short-term benefits. So you need to be thinking through what your next step is. I think there's a lot of interesting combination data coming forward. Whether or not we eventually use it in combination with ibrutinib, I think remains to be seen. You're actually showing slides with a study that I thought was very intriguing, recently shown that actually looked at venetoclax in combination with lenalidomide and rituximab. That's a combination that's been mentioned, and people are not too enthusiastic with it in mantle cell lymphoma because it has modest activity. But in this early data that we saw released of the combination with venetoclax added into R-squared, again, short-term follow-up, but very remarkable responses seen and high rates of MRD negativity. So I think venetoclax has a lot of promise, but it's going to need to be used in combination. What combination? I think we still need more data.
And of course, we saw some awesome venetoclax BTK ibrutinib data in CLL, the GLOW study at EHA. We talked about that already. So before we hear what the faculty has to say, Craig, any thoughts about the question from the audience?
When I think of non-nodal mantle cell lymphoma, is that what you said, non-nodal, correct?
Yep.
So then I'm thinking of either a SOX11 negative mantle cell lymphoma, either through the GI tract or through someone in leukemic phase. So the first question is, for me, I might not even have the information that the patient is P53 positive, because if I had the SOX11 data in the clinical presentation, I personally would be monitoring the patient, and I don't necessarily want to know necessarily the patient's P53 positive, because I'm still going to monitor the patient. It just implies that when treatment is going to start, you have to go down a pathway where you should be comfortable with the fact that aggressive therapy, for example, with Ara-C-based induction and auto transplant, is probably not overly beneficial. You need to go down a more novel pathway, at least I would, in patients with P53 positive mantle cell lymphoma. I try not to have that information. I think some people may say that's counterintuitive, but if I'm going to monitor a patient, it's sort of, and then I know that the patient's P53 positive, and I got to tell the patient, I feel like it's a ticking time bomb.
And so I never know what you're going to say when I ask you questions. That's what I love about working with you, Craig. All right, so Steve, I want you to take a listen to what our faculty says about P53, and then you can keep Craig's comments in mind as well. But I mean, it is a practical question. A lot of people are asking it. I want to know whether chemotherapy works in these patients, Steve. Anyhow, here's the other faculty members.
I'm starting to hear whispers that combinations of a BTK inhibitor with something else like venetoclax might be useful in those P53 mutated patients. I have a couple people with P53 mutated disease, and honestly, even BTK inhibitor based therapy has been pretty limited, and that's a place where we're heading toward CAR T cells a little more quickly.
P53 is something that carries a worse prognosis in mantle cell lymphoma, and you should think about those patients a little bit differently and potential for bringing CAR T cells in earlier for those patient populations.
So, Laurie, this is your Chalk Talk slide about CAR T and mantle cell. There's a lot that can be said about that. Maybe you can just sort of summarize what you're thinking nowadays in terms of when CAR T is coming into your plate. Is it different in a P53 patient?
Yeah, so, I think we still, don't have the data on the relative benefit of CAR T in P53 patients specifically. It's still not data that I get in my own practice. So I have to say that P53 status does not influence my management. And even if I had it readily available for all patients, I'm not so sure that it would change my algorithm. But I think in general, mantle cell lymphoma patients, chemoimmunotherapy plus or minus transplant is still frontline for the overwhelming majority of patients. I would probably also go that route with a P53 patient. BTK inhibitors form pretty much standard second line. And beyond that, I think we really struggle to find treatments that provide durable benefit. So the data from CAR T cell therapy is certainly very, very intriguing. These are patients who had failed two lines of therapy, including chemoimmunotherapy, BTK inhibitors, and we saw remarkable response rates and durable benefits in patients that I wouldn't have expected to see it to that degree with, you know, the agents that I have on the table in my own clinical practice. So I would be strongly considering it in the third line position right now.
So a final comment on mantle cell from Steve. This is the audience take, and they're pretty much on board for CAR T after BR and a BTK, although a fair number say R squared first. The faculty is more on board, and Craig wanted me to clarify he meant R-CHOP as a bridge to CAR T. Maybe that's also what John Gribben thought as well, but clearly I think third line therapy is where it's being used right now. And Laurie just went through her CHOL talk. Any final comments about mantle cell, P53, and CAR T therapy, Steve?
I guess I would just say one thing about P53 in mantle cell is that I don't think we kind of know exactly that it has all of the implications that we've learned from CLL. And some of the mutations are a little different, and some of them are not as predictive as we would expect. I think Craig made an excellent point that some of the patients can be observed. And then I kind of see P53 as a quality control. So you have to do something to the cell for the cell to kind of look itself over, not be happy, and then need to shut down. And then if you lack the shutting down mechanism, then basically you get a problem. But that's, again, speaks to which treatment you give. If you're giving cellular therapy, if you're giving other treatments that are not your typical chemotherapy, you may not necessarily have a problem with getting responses to P53 mutated patients. And I would also say that most in CLL, most of the data came out of fludarabine-treated patients, and we don't really use that drug much in mantle cell. So I would just say, Laurie's point's well taken, is that it might not be as impactful on our algorithm as yet. We're going to need more data to see how this all sort of shakes out.
So I did see one more question in the chat room. I'm going to give it back to Craig. Same situation, so third-line mantle cell that we just described, but the patient's 91 but in perfect health. So do you have a number, Craig, where you're not going to send a patient a CAR T in terms of age?
Well. I mean, 91 is, I'm sure there'll be people who will do CAR T cells in folks that are 91. That patient should seek out that center. I would say that we probably can do a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and the patient will die with mantle cell lymphoma, not of it.
So let's move on now and talk about diffuse large B-cell. Again, we're holding our breaths and waiting to see whether or not the paradigm and diffuse large B-cell is going to move CAR T up. We have several questions we want to address in this module, beginning with where CAR T fits in the algorithm today. Of course, we haven't seen these new data, so we're in the situation where we are today. Here's the other faculty members in terms of their thoughts about CAR T and diffuse large B-cell.
I generally tell patients it's a third, a third, a third, meaning one third of patients it doesn't work or they don't get to the CAR T cells. One third of the patients it works for a modest amount of time and then they relapse. And one third of patients it works for a durable remission and maybe cure.
This is where we run into all the challenges and logistics of delivery of CAR T, which, you know, the frustrating reality is that probably fewer than half, maybe even fewer than a third of such patients who would be eligible are getting it. So there's a huge access issue. That's some of what we're trying to work on and solve. Large cell lymphomas had four recent approvals in this space: loncastuximab, polatuzumab, lenalidomide, tafasitamab, selinexor, and, you know, we'll probably soon have the bispecifics in this space as well. So you could consider any of those potentially as bridging agents to CAR T.
I think we will see in a number of settings that CAR T cells move up, both for early relapses for patients who are relapsing after frontline therapy, and maybe even for patients who have high-risk diffuse large B-cell or other large B-cell lymphomas that are CD19 positive in the frontline setting.
Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your perspective, CAR T is really moving largely to an outpatient basis, not for the reasons that we would like, which would be because that's what patients prefer, but because of financial considerations.
So Laurie, I'm gonna be curious for your thoughts about what your colleagues just said about CAR T and diffuse large B-cell. Here are some of the thoughts of the audience. So right now they're still in the autologous transplant mode on first relapse. We'll see what they say in 6 months or maybe after ASH. This kind of ties into the 91-year-old issue, Laurie, which as we said, does a patient really need to be in the same physical condition as in autologous transplant? About half of the audience actually agrees with that. But most of the faculty disagree, although including you, Laurie. So any thoughts about some of the comments that were just made about CAR-T, outpatient CAR-T, and also what kind of shape or age a patient needs to be in to go for CAR-T with diffuse large B-cell, Laurie?
Mm-hmm. You know, so I think there's general consensus that the threshold for taking a patient to autologous stem cell transplant is different than CAR T cells. So the group of patients eligible for CAR T would be greater, primarily because I think that, you know, the toxicity with the high dose chemotherapy is just something that can't be tolerated or delivered beyond a certain age, whereas in theory, there's no age cutoff for CAR T cell therapy. But we do know that there are definite toxicities, but you know, picking patients based on age alone, I think, is difficult. So in my own clinic, though, I do make judgment calls all the time because I think that there's no absolute criteria that people can say this is a CAR T cell candidate, this isn't. But I would say that, you know, short of being extremely frail and having, you know, excessive comorbidities and a performance status of 3 or higher, I would say that in my mind, everybody else is a potential CAR T cell candidate.
So another thought we ran by the auxiliary faculty, Steve, and I'm curious what your thoughts are, is we now have 3 approved CAR T products in diffuse large B cell. And the question is, can we separate them out in any way in terms of tolerability, production issues, or efficacy? Steve, here's what our other faculty members think. I'm curious what your thoughts are. Here's the other people.
We use all 3 forms of CAR T cell therapy at MD Anderson. And there were a handful of observational studies presented. The efficacy of the CAR T cell therapies look more the same than they do different in terms of their response rates. The duration of response appears fairly similar. The differences in CRS and ICANS do look somewhat different between axicabtagene siluso, where that appears to be higher, anticigen lecleucel, lisocabtagene.
The longest long-term data is with axicabtagene. And, you know, I think it has the best long-term data. From a safety perspective, I prefer lisocel. But, you know, again, these do rely on some cross-trial comparisons and all the usual caveats.
People who wouldn't be candidates for auto transplant who could get CAR T, but one should not mistake that this is always an easy benign therapy. There are patients who get as sick or sicker with this as you can see with auto transplant. So it's not an exclusion if you're older, but it's also not necessarily a piece of cake for everybody.
So, Steve, this is the Chalk Talk slide you put together. I'm curious what you think about what your colleagues just said, how that ties into what you put together here.
Yeah, so I think, you know, a number of points that were made are really important. I think in general, if you take all of the agents and say, what's the benefit from each of the agents and the durability of benefit, they do seem to look pretty similar. But there are some differences that potentially could play into your decision. Some of them are more theoretical, I think, than practical. So I've tried to put the practical here. I think really it comes down to which agent is your center the most comfortable with. You know, you get better at doing things when you do them often. And so if you have a center that's using one product over another and they're getting good at it, that will make an impact on how patients do with that agent. I think the other thing is some of them take a little longer to develop. And so, again, if you have to give bridging treatment or you're just waiting, that may play into your decision making. I think on top of that, you might say, you know, the CD28 co-stimulatory domain may have a little bit more side effects, at least initially, but those side effects may be more cytokine release. And then the 4-1BB molecules, there may be some data that says HLH and other problems may be a little bit more frequently seen there. So I think those differences may play into one's decision, but I think the broad answer might well be patients actually seem to do quite similarly between the agents, although a head-to-head comparison is going to be needed to know that for a fact.
So Steve, quick follow-up from the chat room. I never thought about this. It's a great question. For CAR T, any difference in response based on GCB versus ABC subtype?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And to the best of my knowledge, there's not been a clear difference. And in some respects, I kind of would have expected there to potentially to be a difference just because the tumor biology may be different. But I'm not aware, maybe others on the group are, that there's a difference between ABC or GCB.
Craig, you had a question?
Yeah, I think in the era of COVID, of which we are now well into our second year, I think if one can avoid admission to the hospital with AxiCell and give another product as an outpatient, now running a cancer center, to be honest with you, I would rather prefer that. We're really trying our best to keep the patients out. We're in the middle of yet another fairly large surge. So that's why I picked, when you'll see that I do believe there is a difference. I want to keep people out of the hospital, at least now. I think it's safer for everybody.
Yeah, I'm starting to get some bad flashback feelings nowadays, but hopefully things get better. So another question, Laurie, I'm curious what your thoughts are. We talked about all the new agents coming into practice. I joke the oncologists get up in the morning, they check their phone to see what's approved, and then start figuring out how they're going to go through their day. So we have several new choices available, and I know that general oncologists are trying to sort these out. That was the number one question, incidentally, asked about diffuse large B-cell, in addition to a bunch of things about CAR-T, sequencing of these new agents. Let's start with our other faculty first, and then we'll see what Laurie has to say.
I think the more robust data that we have are Pola-BR and tafasitamab lenalidomide. Those are both regimens that I think are fairly easy for people to use in practice in the community. Tafasitamab would typically be my first choice. The tolerability is pretty good. People are used to using lenalidomide, and tafasitamab's toxicity is pretty manageable in that combination.
The tafa-len regimen uses a completely different mechanism of action than giving chemotherapy. It is well tolerated. And frankly, the results are excellent, with high overall response rate, 60% and higher, long duration of remission, progression-free survival. I mean, it really, these curves go on for years.
What about polatuzumab BR?
Yeah, I think that's a great regimen, and I use it frequently. I use it sometimes in the setting we just talked about, the older patients that you're not going for curative therapy. The other place that I use it all the time in is those patients that you need bridging therapy for CAR T cells.
We did a lot of early work with polatuzumab all the way up through pivotal studies. I like the drug. I think it's very effective. Loncastuximab is one that has only just very recently been approved, has maybe some third space fluid issues, so you might shy away. And cardiac has a weird GGT toxicity. The most impressive at surface level is lenalidomide with tafasitamab. You do see some really long PFS.
So, Laurie, and of course, the other question is, when are we going to see the upfront polatuzumab sort of R-CHOP phase 3 trial that you're doing? Anything you want to tell us about that? Are we getting close?
Yeah, so I imagine several people on this call might be involved with that trial, but you're referring to the Polarix trial, which investigated the use of polatuzumab in the upfront setting, so replacing vincristine and R-CHOP. And, rumor has it that we're expecting that data to emerge probably by the end of summer and certainly by ASH. So I think we're not far away from hearing what those results show and whether or not we have a new frontline therapy for patients with DLBCL.
So what about, Laurie, the choice between these available agents, patients not eligible for CAR-T or they've already had CAR-T? How do you think that through, assuming you had everything available, no access issues, just purely based on sort of the oncology science, how would you be thinking through sequencing these agents, Laurie?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's no right answer. So, you know, we now have numerous, like really a glut of novel agents to use in patients, which previously, you know, we didn't have anything that allowed us to give these patients post transplant or even post-CAR-T now durable remissions. And I think one of the things that's most exciting is we can take patients that we weren't even able to palliate before and now provide them with durable disease control with some of these novel agents. There's no head-to-head comparison. And I think in any given patient, you need to weigh out what are the goals of therapy? You know, is this going to be a bridge to another more effective therapy? Are we just trying to get, you know, a patient the least toxic therapy that we have that buys them some control. You know, Pola-BR and tafasitamab, lenalidomide, I think has probably the best data in terms of trying to get durable benefit. But, you know, the trial populations that they looked at were very different. Initially, the TAFA-LEN trial excluded patients with primary refractory disease, which we know are very difficult patients to treat. So I'd like to see more data emerging on that subgroup of patients to know whether or not I can weigh in with that regimen in a patient who has, you know, rapidly evolving disease that's out of control. Because I think one of the most impressive things about Pola-BR is it, you know, has a high likelihood of benefit, but it works very quickly. Also, one of the major differences between those two strategies is, you know, one is a time-limited therapy and the other one, you know, has prolonged administration of therapy. But I do agree that, you know, for patients who have multiple lines of chemotherapy, the TAFA-LEN concept, you know, getting away from chemotherapy, I think is very attractive. But I do think we need to learn more about the types of patients that preferentially benefit from the different treatments. And I'm sure all of that data will emerge over time.
So, Steve, given that CAR-T and TAFA both target CD19, are you concerned about using TAFA after CAR-T, or I'll say before, similar to arguments or discussions we've heard in myeloma about anti-BCMA like Belimumab before or after CAR-T? But before you discuss that, Greg, I want you to just think about two other cases from the chat room that you can talk about after Steve talks. One is refractory Burkitt's. Any data on CAR-T? The other case is a patient with diffuse large B-cell, HIV, recurrence after R-CHOP, double hit. How about CAR-T in that situation? While Craig's thinking about that, Steve, we asked the faculty about using CD19 after CD19 and whether it's considered reasonable at this point. We don't really have a lot of data. Everybody thinks it is. In myeloma, I think they're going on the same sort of thinking. You put this chalk talk together, Steve. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the key thing is just it's theoretical that you'd have potential blocking of a receptor, which makes it difficult for the next agent to work. And there's actually now clinical and preclinical data that would say that's probably not true. And part of it is because I think CD19 is so rapidly cycled on the cell surface that it's actually quite difficult for the antibody to no longer bind, because there's always, as it were, fresh CD19 for it to bind to. However, I do think if you get a mutation in that receptor, or if the cell totally downregulates CD19, that's different. And then I think it's actually quite a lot more difficult to have a good effect in those cases. So I think if you know that CAR T cells were given and you know that the reason they didn't work is because there was loss of CD19 or because there's a mutation in CD19, then I think you might pick a different option. But otherwise, I don't think there's a problem.
So one more chalk talk slide I'd like, Steve, I'd like you to take a look at. You covered this again, all these data in your talk. We've been talking about trying how to sequence these new therapies. We haven't said much about selinexor, but that's another approved option. So four there. You put together this sort of algorithm. Would you like to translate it for us, Steve?
Yeah, so I think, you know, most people feel quite comfortable treating patients with an R-CHOP, and maybe that'll change soon, like frontline therapy. And probably around half to 60% of patients may well then be cured with that therapy. Then there's kind of a split as second-line therapy rolls around. About half the patients are probably transplant-eligible, and the other half are not. In the transplant-eligible patients, obviously a salvage chemotherapy followed by transplant is probably the way to go. On the other hand, you know, different chemotherapy, tafasitamab plus lenalidomide may be an option. The thing that made me smile, I was just working out the number of variables there are. If there are five different treatments, all of which could be sequenced, there are 120 different sequence options if you wanted to work out which you wanted to give first. So that's really the challenge. And I think it comes down to many of the discussions we've just been having. The patient, the access, what they had before, how much they may have benefited from things before, as to which you would pick.
So Craig, give you a second to reflect on these two cases, Burkitt's and HIV and double hit, diffuse large B cell, two different cases.
Well, both of these obviously were ineligible for the clinical trials that went through. A Burkitt lymphoma patient that with relapsed or refractory Burkitt lymphoma. I don't know what my colleagues think, but that's a tough nut to crack. Most of those patients do poorly. So if one could get some bit of control on the disease, I would be comfortable sending the patient for CAR T cells. Once again, I don't do them personally anymore, so it would have to be it would have to be approved and go through the appropriate channels. But I'd be okay with that. A well-compensated HIV patient with normal CD4 counts who relapses after R-CHOP or R-EPOC, who's still that way and is prognostically unfavorable based upon what you said with double hit pathology, which probably is unlikely to be cured with an auto transplant, although everybody has their anecdotes, I would have no problem referring that patient for CAR T cells either. But knowing full well, these patients are really not represented on the clinical trials, to be honest. In Steve's algorithm, I think Steve is prior to this for one quickie. You didn't mention anything in the relapse setting about the prognosis of the patient. So if the patient has got primary refractory or primary progressive disease with bad pathology, bad second line, IPI, I do wonder if the knee-jerk response to give ICE and transplant is going to continue. Favorable patient may go down that pathway, but the unfavorable patient is probably not.
That's a good point, Craig. So let's finish out talking about Hodgkin lymphoma. And I don't have to tell you what the most common question is from the audience, which is the first question we're going to talk about. And we referred to it earlier, first line therapy. Whenever you come up with something, same thing we were talking about with, R-CHOP for follicular lymphoma, pretty hard to unseat something that has been viewed as successful. But it looks like it's starting to happen, or it's been happening over the last few years. Here's our auxiliary faculty talking about first line therapy in younger patients of HL.
Bleomycin is just a drug that has all sorts of liabilities, and brentuximab's biggest liability is neuropathy and cytopenias. And you can overcome the cytopenias to a large extent by the use of growth factors as soon as you get rid of the bleomycin. And the neuropathy, what we see in long-term data is it tends to improve with time. So a younger patient with bad risk disease, I feel like the likelihood of getting to a cure with brentuximab, I do like adding brentuximab when I can.
So what about sort of average risk younger patients?
I will say that I've even changed more recently to probably favor AAVD in that population. Listening to one of your sessions with Craig Moskowitz, I was impressed by his take on the data.
It is nice not to have to deal with bleomycin, and that's a drug that, in young people is pretty benign. That where you get into trouble predominantly is in older people with bleomycin.
In advanced stage Hodgkin's disease, I generally use the AAVD regimen, I would say for 80% of patients or more. At first I thought about, well, maybe we should just use it to high risk people. But if you look at the risk analysis, pretty much all groups that you can think of in that advanced stage group of patients, they benefit from it.
So Craig, this is your Chalk Talk slide about this topic of first line therapy. And at the bottom, you include another very common question we got from the audience, which is stage 2 disease. You can comment on that as well. But maybe you can chat a little bit about first line therapy and really how your views have evolved and how you're seeing other people's views evolve in the beginning. I know there was a lot of discussion about the endpoint that was used, et cetera, but just curious where you see things are now, Craig.
So, as you get more mature in life, many of us have seen people die from bleomycin toxicity. That happens. I can think of 5 or 6 people off the top of my head who've died from bleomycin. I can't do that anymore. So that's one issue. The second issue in the United States, we don't give escalated Biocop in the United States. And even if you speak to Dr. Engert, the utility of escalated Biocop is waning in Germany. So the results of the BVAVD program, as our colleague stated, in the last tick-tonk, I guess you call it, is fairly straightforward. The results are, the long-term results are stable, and you know, even those zealots who have taken a long time to switch over to BVAVD have switched. It's not a perfect protocol, as everybody knows. And I want you to just, for the audience, the critical thing is looking at the first 6 months. There's no difference in patients with primary progressive disease between BVAVD and ABVD. This is where, if you remember Volker Diehl, he would always say that the reason escalated BACOP was superior to ABVD is because of the reduction in primary progression. The curves splayed almost immediately. In the curves here, they splay after 6 months. So that group of patients who are just horrible Hodgkin lymphoma, they're not being cured by either regimen. But those patients with your garden variety advanced stage disease, stage 3B and 4, without all of the risks, with the majority of risk factors, you know, the relapse rate is much less with BVAVD. It's here to stay. And to be honest, despite what everybody wants to look at academic rigor, the intergroup study does not include PET adapted therapy. The intergroup study is BVAVD versus nivolumab and AVD. There's no PET adapted therapy. There's not a three-arm study. To most of the audience, you weren't born when ABVD was initiated, published in 1974. So it's time to change.
So, Laurie, any thoughts about that? You know, again, as Craig was saying, there was a lot of controversy initially. The hazard rate is not like what you see in some, you know, some trials. You know, the osimertinib hazard rate was 0.2. This is, you know, in the range of 0.75. But there are lots of drugs that are approved that we're using with that kind of impact, particularly if there's no increase in toxicity. You can argue about that. Where are you on this topic, Laurie?
Yeah, so maybe a little bit different than Craig. I mean, I do see it being a big step up in toxicity for my patients. So everybody needs to take growth factors. You know, it is more intensive therapy for sure. I think that in my own clinic, I tend to, for the majority of patients, still go down the ABVD route and use the PET adaptive approach, because we know that 80% of them are going to be PET negative after two cycles. I can drop the bleomycin, the one drug that I heard people complaining about the most, and their reason for using BVAVD was to drop bleo. But 80% of my patients who go down ABVD get to drop bleo. And it's a remarkably tolerable regimen when you're talking about ABVD followed by, you know, four more cycles of AVD. I am most concerned about patients with higher risk. So all of my stage four patients, I would give BVAVD, because I think that, you know, we are concerned that those are the patients who are most likely to be PET positive after the two cycles. And really what to do with those patients, I think, still remains quite controversial. But I guess I haven't bought into the theory that everybody should get BVAVD, because, you know, it is more toxic, it's more expensive, and patients can do very, very well with a PET adapted approach with extremely low toxicity. So I'm a little bit more selective. All of my stage four patients get the BVAVD, and then short of being stage four, I would look at stage three with higher number of risk factors.
So there's always bringing the patient and family involved in these difficult decisions, and I know that happens all the time. I'll hold off for a second on Steve's opinion, because of course I want to get a tiebreaker thought about this. But before that, I want to add on another question to you, Steve, which we also asked our TikTok faculty, which is upfront treatment advanced stage disease in the older patient. We said like around 80, for example. Here's what the faculty has to say.
These patients are relatively uncommon in general medical practice. For a lymphoma-focused practice, this is something that we see on a regular basis. So, you know, when you think of the epidemiology of Hodgkin lymphoma, that biggest peak is in the age 20, but there's actually a second smaller peak around the age of 80. I typically would use brentuximab plus DTIC. I think brentuximab plus checkpoint is another reasonable option.
Everyone's definition of older has a different set point there, but I have used BV dacarbazine in that older patient population. It's been pretty successful, honestly, better than I would have thought.
An 85-year-old with follicular lymphoma comes in with just a swollen node. An 85-year-old with Hodgkin's tends to be pretty sick. I do think that, you know, a brentuximab vedotin itself is limited. So using it in combination with something is probably what I would do, using DTIC. And then I would probably use a checkpoint inhibitor kind of in the second line setting more commonly.
BV is monotherapy, high response rate, short duration, but boy, you add anything to it and the response durations really improve. The carbazine is readily available and some great data with the combo. PD-1 inhibitors, also clearly very effective drugs in this space.
So Steve, your thoughts about first-line therapy in the younger patient, and in a second, we'll get to Craig's chalk talk slide about older patient. But Steve, what are your thoughts about these two scenarios?
So I think it's very interesting to me that historically we had, you know, intensive escalated BICOP on the one side and ABVD on the other. And we've kind of moved to the middle with the brentuximab AVD kind of being more in the middle space. And I think in my practice, a little bit more in line with what Laurie was saying, if you're a high-risk patient, advanced stage disease, multiple negative factors, in the past we would have thought about escalated BICOP. Now I would typically give brentuximab AVD. If you're low-risk and don't have a lot of really negative prognostic factors, even with more advanced stage, I will typically give ABVD and then drop the bleomycin after two cycles. I will say, though, that for the elderly patients, I think in my practice, I've sort of noticed that you can use brentuximab vedotin as a single agent for two cycles and see how it goes. Because if the patient tolerates that very well, often the sick patients that was mentioned in the video, they actually are a lot healthier at that point. And then there's data from Andy Evans where you can give AVD chemotherapy for four cycles or six cycles in between and then give more brentuximab vedotin at the end. If they were pretty fragile and didn't even tolerate the brentuximab very well, you might then consider either nivolumab or DTIC or just single agent therapy. I would say, though, that the durability of response, if you use single agent brentuximab vedotin, and even in the studies where brentuximab has been added to a PD-1 blocking antibody, relapses are much more frequent. So if your goal is still to try and get rid of the disease permanently, I think adding some chemotherapy is going to be needed in elderly people.
So I just want to go back to you for a second, Steve. You know, a lot of people are bringing up this issue of, you know, not necessarily favoring BV-ABD in the, quote, average risk extensive stage disease. When you discuss that with a patient, and let's say you recommend ABVD, Steve, do you say, but you're going to have a little bit higher chance of having a relapse and go to a transplant? Do you believe that?
So I do think that if you're actually going to start with ABVD and get two cycles and then follow the RAFL trial, we don't actually know if that is an inferior outcome necessarily compared to brentuximab vedotin AVD, because we really didn't use a therapy adjusted approach in the echelon one trial. So I think with all of that said, we actually still don't know the academically interesting question, and that is whether RAFL versus AVD kind of plus brentuximab is the best way to go. But I do think we're never going to know that. So I think it now comes down to individualizing patients based on their wishes and on the physician's choice.
So Craig, I'm going to give you the last word, and you can comment on what Steve just said in terms of the RAFL approach. Also, Dr. McKenna in the chat room wants to know, what do you do with older patients who have diabetes or neuropathy from diabetes? How does that affect your use of brentuximab in this situation? And then finally, to comment on your slide that you put together talking about older patients.
So the first thing is, I think both Laurie and Steve should remember that the intergroup study does not have PET adapted therapy. So despite all of us being quite academic, and I, for one, took a while to move over to BV-AVD. I used to only give it for stage 4 patients. The lymphoma community has decided to study it in stage 3 and 4 disease. So we're moving forward, whether we like it or not. The second issue is that I really dislike not treating older patients with curative intent. Not everybody who's 75 can't get AVD, okay? So you now being older than 60, I would like to be cured with Hodgkin lymphoma if either Steve or Laurie gave me chemotherapy. I want to get multi-agent chemotherapy. So there's an approach that Andy Evans designed, which was induction BV, as Steve said, for two cycles, followed by AVD, no bleomycin, followed by BV mop-up, those results are excellent. So I tend to recommend that any patient age 60 to 80 who is in good shape. Obviously, in patients who are not in good shape, all bets are off. I try to get a checkpoint inhibitor in as quickly as possible. So usually I'll start with single agent BV. The complete response is unlikely, and I'll try to add nivolumab or pembrolizumab to that. But I got to remind everybody, please participate in the intergroup study. It's a 1,000-patient study. The Canadians are also involved, as you're well aware, Lori. So, and we'll have an answer. And, you know, and if one is better than another, we're going to have a new standard of care in Hodgkin lymphoma, and it's not going to be PET adaptive therapy.
Craig. One more. I got it from the audience. I got to do one more poll question. Current outside of trial setting, and you can talk about what's going on in trials too, Craig. Management of double or triple hit diffuse large B-cell, upfront treatment. Craig, any thoughts?
Well, I used to give a lot of our epoch, but apparently there is some data coming out, an update of the intergroup study, of the CLGB study in double hit large cell lymphoma, that R-CHOP and R-EPOCH is equivalent. Now, I haven't seen that, but I have seen it come across one of these, I got an email about it. I have routinely given R-EPOCH and then monitored the patient. I think most of my colleagues have done that as well, whether it's HIV positive or HIV negative.
All right, we have one more. Laurie, agree or disagree?
So if the question is, what do I do for double hit lymphoma? So we do give dose-adjusted EPOCH-R. I think there's no comparative data out there that is randomized, that has enough power to answer the question. So, there's some retrospective data that's been public, or I guess presented recently at one of the summer meetings, that suggested there was no difference. I have to tell you that we're in the process of looking at our own data and our outcomes since we introduced dose-adjusted EPOCH-R. And, I'll say, remains to be seen. We're going to present this at ASH, but I think it'll keep the controversy going.
Okay. Dr. Kumar in the chat room says there was a recent meta-analysis, a retrospective that showed no difference. Maybe that's what Dr. McKenna was referring to also. Craig, you didn't answer the question about the patient with neuropathy and diabetes.
I don't give Brentuximab.